50 degrees Kenosha, 49 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Doug Instanis from the Racine Theater Guild is going to be joining us for part two of today's program. He had another interview at another radio station in the area, so we wanted to accommodate that. And what was going to be part two, a really interesting interview from the archives, is going to be our part one, a look at one of the most amazing objects on the planet, the Hope Diamond. Again, Doug Instanis will join us halfway through today's program to preview the Racine Theater Guild's upcoming production of the musical Cabaret, which opens this Friday night. Here's part one on WGTD's Morning Show. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about one of the world's most beautiful and mysterious objects, the Hope Diamond. Not the world's largest diamond, but one of its most beautiful and one of its most intriguing. My guest is Richard Curran, who is the Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian, where the Hope Diamond is housed. He has written several other interesting books, including The Smithsonian's History of America in 101 Objects and Reflections of a Cultural Broker, A View from the Smithsonian. This book we'll be talking about today, published by the Smithsonian, is called The Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. Explain to our listeners why someone at the Smithsonian is writing an extensive history of the Hope Diamond.
Well, because the Hope Diamond, interestingly enough, is, of course, at the Smithsonian. It's the center of our national gem collection. It has a very special place, and it is the most visited object in any museum on the planet.
Really?
Some 4 million to 5 million people every year come to the museum to look at that diamond. And, of course, when it was acquired in 1958, donated to the Smithsonian by famed diamond merchant Harry Winston, many Americans wrote to the Smithsonian and said, don't take it, this diamond is cursed, and if the U.S. takes it, then our country will be cursed. So I found it very fascinating to work here.
Absolutely. We're talking about a beautiful diamond, but also one which is maybe a little smaller than people might imagine. I think someplace in the book you liken it to the size of a walnut.
And it's a good-sized walnut, I think.
Right. Well, and that's a good-sized diamond. But, I mean, yeah. Compared, for instance, to the picture on the cover of your book, we're not talking about something that's quite as huge as that.
No, in fact, when we interview people that come to the Smithsonian and before they've seen the Hope Diamond, they kind of think it's the size of about a softball.
Right.
And then they think it's about the size of a baseball sometimes. It's surprising, again, how small it is given its reputation, its fame, and infamy. But, indeed, a 45.5-carat diamond is a pretty big chunk of stone.
Hmm. One of the things you've done here is done to the best of your ability or anyone's ability to trace, in effect, the factual history of the Hope Diamond, but along with it trying to trace the roots of this really extraordinary legend which has sprung up around it, the story of the curse of the Hope Diamond. And really, we get the sense that that the story of that curse is a relatively recent phenomenon from maybe about 100 years ago or so.
Well, that's true. And, what I try to do in the book is really look at this object because it is traceable over, you know, about a 350-year history as it moves across the planet from India to France to England to the United States. And so it's almost like a biography of an object that's lived for a long time and touched, you know, everybody from Marie Antoinette to various first ladies of the United States getting involved to being implicated with, you know, jewelers and national collections and so on. So it has a very, very rich biography. But the curse, as told, really comes along at the beginning of the 1900s, very relatively late in its biography, but it does take hold. And it's immediately attributed an ancient origin, but it was really used as a ploy by Cartier, the jewelers Cartier, to sell the diamond to a very wealthy American at the turn of the the 20th century, early 1900s.
You described that transaction where the Hope Diamond was unveiled for this wealthy woman, and that initial transaction didn't really take hold, but I guess eventually it did. But you talk about how the tale that Cartier spun about the Hope Diamond and of the misfortune which had befallen so many who had owned it. You said Cartier's tale had all the characteristics of a legend. It was regarded as a long-lived tale, widely known and passed down over time. It purported to be factual, but self-referentially admitted that some of those facts might seem fantastic and even fictional. Given the personalities, it was endowed with special significance. Indeed, it became instant folklore early in the era of modern mass communication. What a fascinating concept, that of instant folklore. I mean, it's a contradiction in terms, of course, and yet here it is.
Yeah, well, I think you can look at other kinds of things of the era. You know, Cartier told this story of how it had been stolen from the eye of an idol of India, brought back to the West, and immediately, you know, it was implicated in the French Revolution, later in the Turkish and Russian revolutions, had brought misfortune to various owners, divorce, bankruptcy, and death. And so it was a very compelling tale. And the person he was telling this to was Evelyn Walsh McLean and her husband Ned McLean. They owned the Washington Post. good friends of Florence Harding, who was later to become First Lady of the United States. This acquired a certain characteristic at the end of the Gilded Age. It had a lot in common, if you think about it, with the curse of the Titanic. And the curse later, about 10 years later, of the of Tutankhamun, and that is, it resonated with the idea that there was because of basically disparities of wealth in the United States, and because of the relationship between the West and the East, basically colonialism, that the curse of the diamond was payback, and it was payback for rich folks stealing the money or getting the money from poor folks, or it was payback for the West robbing the East of its treasures. And somehow that resonated at the time. There was a good bit of resentment against folks that, you know, would put diamonds around the necks of their dogs and parade them while other poor people didn't have enough to eat or didn't have jobs. And so the curse, you know, in a sense, it was a made-up story, but it was true in the sense that it resonated with deep-seated feelings, almost, if you will, of class warfare, or the idea that, as one very wealthy American at the time said, you know, God gave me my money. And the idea that appealed to people with the curse is, so you think God gave you your money, wouldn't it be interesting if another God took it away?
We're speaking with Richard Curran about his book called Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. One thing that we probably need to talk about right off the bat is that what we know now as the Hope Diamond, we think, trace its history all the way back to when and even where this gem was unearthed. But in fact, there is an interruption in that history. The sense I get is that we can't maybe be absolutely certain, but it's a very good probability that the long history that you have traced is of indeed the same gem, which undergoes some alterations over the year.
Yeah.
Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're pretty, we're about 99% sure that we can trace the diamond to its origins. There's a French trader, Jean-Baptiste Tavernier, who goes to India in the 1600s, and pretty sure that he acquires this diamond that was called the Tavernier Violet. He basically held it for a number of years and brought it back to France. But it was 112 carats, and he acquired it in India. And the records of him taking it back, selling it to French King Louis XIV are pretty good. And recent experiments at the Smithsonian pretty much show that our cut-down Hope Diamond, which is now 44 carats, is traceable to a French diamond known as the French Blue that was 67 carats. That's traceable back to this Tavernier Violet diamond that was 112 carats. So the lineage is pretty clear, but again, there's always a little bit of doubt.
Hmm. When he acquires this first great diamond, it is apparently 112 carats.
Yes.
And maybe we should talk at this moment about what diamonds look like when they come out of the earth. And maybe... Back then, we're talking about the mid-17th century, even at their best, so to speak, at the most polished, what a diamond would look like back in those days.
Well, I actually tried to, track down, track Tavernier's, footsteps back to the diamond mine, the particular diamond mine at which he acquired this blue diamond that later became the Hope. And, when you're in that area in India... I was looking on the ground to see if something would shine and I could find diamonds in the rough. The truth of the matter is that diamonds don't really shine and sparkle the way we're used to seeing them in diamond rings. They really have to be cut in a certain way to do that. Diamonds in the rough, can very much be taken as quartz or roughly cut glass. And the Indians, when Tavernier discovered this blue diamond, India was really the only source of diamonds known in the world, and particularly big ones. And the Indians classified diamonds as male and female and neuter. They associated diamonds with different gods and castes. And the Indians thought that diamonds were really protection, almost creating a force field against bad effects. And so they did not cut them in geometric ways that we later did in Europe. So diamonds in the rough are a far cry from what we see on people's rings.
Mm. This diamond trade with which Tavernier was a participant was actually part of an even wider scope form of commerce, which he was also part of what you call mercantile globalism, and especially a trafficking transcontinentally in luxury goods of all kinds. Although we get the sense that diamonds were something sort of exceptionally special in this field.
Well, yeah, and it's remarkable. We're used to globalization now, where we think of products and information going around the globe. But globalization, certainly in this scale and the extensiveness, is rather new. But even going back to the 1600s, you had people like Tavernier, who there he is in India and in Ceylon at the time, and he's saying, the price of those South African emeralds are depressing, the luxury stone market in India. So here he is in the 1600s worrying about South African emeralds undercutting the price of emeralds from Ceylon. I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
And
thinking
about
the world in those terms that long ago.
Yeah, and again, one of the things that he had to do is think about the notion of how you recorded the weight, the size and the value of diamonds, because diamonds were implicated in, exchange rates. How many francs for a diamond in Indian rupees and Indian currency? And so all these calculations that we're used to looking at exchange rates in the financial pages of our newspapers or on the net, you had Tavernier and other traders having to do that on the spot as they're moving from culture to culture. How many pearls for how many diamonds and so on.
I especially enjoyed your description of a typical transaction in Golconda, the legendary city of, is it a city of gold or city of...
City of diamonds. That was really the trade area, yeah.
Yes. And describe to our listeners a buyer and seller sitting across from each other how a transaction would be done?
Well, typically, if Tavernier came into the market in Golconda, which was the name of the capital city where the diamonds, most of the diamond mines were, and you would sit down, the diamond seller would put these diamonds on basically a black rock set in the ground, and display a diamond, and then basically these two guys, the buyer and the seller, would stick their hands under the sleeve of each other and use their fingers as code so that other people would not see the price. And they'd use, you know, kind of one finger or a squeeze at the elbow, and that would mean 1,000 rupees. They'd use fingers on their wrists or hands. And so they use this intricate code to negotiate diamonds so other people would not know the exact price they were paying. You can think of that almost like what happens in the New York Stock Exchange or in the commodity markets today, where if you're looking from the outside, you have all sorts of people using hand signals and other things to negotiate and to trade stocks. And if you're an outsider, you have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Something else you mentioned in this early chapter is the way in which the Indians viewed these kind of precious gems. You talk about how they saw them as possessing sort of special powers of strength and protection, that kings and queens needed gems to help them rule effectively and not be overcome by evil forces. So for them, it was not a matter of ostentation, of wearing a gem because it shows how rich you are. It had nothing to do with that, or not much to do with that.
Yeah, as one you know, jeweler, you know, told me in an interview, these gems were used by Indian gods and goddesses, kings and queens, as almost protection. The idea is that gems, shiny rocks found in the earth, actually are bits of fallen stars and planets from above. And when you wear them, they basically have the power almost to suck in bad stuff and absorb it. And so it's almost a protection. It's almost an amulet of protection against bad stuff in the universe. And, of course, gods that are called the Shining Ones, and kings and queens often take on that appellation too, the idea is that it sucks in the bad stuff and shines out the good stuff. Think of it as almost a Pandora's box that absorbs all the evil and all the bad stuff in society. And, of course, I think what happens with the thinking about the curse is as gems travel back to the West, what do people in the West do? Well, during the Renaissance, they develop a sense of optics. They develop a sense of light coming out. And so they start cutting these diamonds in very geometric ways that the stuff shines out. And so all the bad stuff accumulated in these gems in the East is all of a sudden let out, and it shines in the West. And I think that's the kind of underlying logic of the curse. When you read about things by the 20th century in the United States and in Europe, the idea is that these gems from India have baleful and woeful influences. There's a light inside that's let loose on society. And so the Pandora's box of all the evils that have accumulated in the East are then let loose in the West. And I think that's the underlying logic of the curse.
Richard Curran is the author of this really interesting book called Hope Diamond, The Legendary History of a Cursed Gem. We will be archiving the interview in its entirety in the podcast version of today's program. The book, by the way, is published by Smithsonian Books. The time is 8:28. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two is coming up in just a moment. The time is exactly 8:30, and you're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Put down the knitting, the book, and the broom. It's time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow your horn. Start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. What good's permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away? Life is a cabaret, old chum. So come to the I used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and said, what good is sitting all alone in your room? Come, hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
That amazing song, of course, is from an amazing musical by John Kander and Fred Ebb, Cabaret, which is about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. And I'm very happy to welcome into our studios for part two of today's morning show, Doug Instanis, the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild, and also the director of this production of Cabaret. And it's one of these iconic shows that a lot of people have of course heard of, but it doesn't necessarily mean you've had the opportunity to experience it in person and on stage. And so this is a relatively rare treat to be able to enjoy this great work, which opens this weekend, as we said, and runs for the next three weekends. Doug Instanis, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning.
Glad you're here. I should mention that you were at another radio station, which will remain unnamed, but talking about Cabaret. And as a matter of fact, the leading lady in our cast, Kaylee Annabelle, who plays Sally Bowles, got up bright and early to join you.
It impresses me
a lot.
So. Late night, coming home from dress rehearsal and getting up early in the morning.
A trooper. We'll look forward to perhaps having Kaylee with us and maybe several other cast members sometime next week. But today, it is director Doug Instanis joining us to talk about this musical. First of all, before we get into what Cabaret is about, I think it'd be interesting for people to know just how deep an acquaintance you yourself have with this show. It sounds like this is something that you have seen quite a lot on the stage over the years. Just kind of give us at least the laundry list.
Well, I first saw it shortly after I got out of high school. A friend of mine was in a production, and so he was first professional production, so we all went and was like, whoa, this is pretty racy, you know. And of course, this is 80s for me, so it's been out for a long time. And then I've seen the Milwaukee Rep production, Parkside did it, Carthage has done it, the movie, and of course it's online with 20 different versions from high schools to the London show. So I'm you know, it's exciting for me to watch because it's gone through so many transformations over time. And I just really would love to talk to the playwrights and the directors on why did you swap out that song? And why did you move that one around? And why did you change? What was wrong with the first one? You know, because it was, you know, Academy Award winning, you know, Tony Award winning show. And then we, you know, I think over time, everybody wants to mess with it and put their own little take on it. So
including John Kander and Fred Ebb, who created it in the first place. But yeah, it's like they've had a kind of a restless relationship with this. They wanted it to be still better or always fresh or something. But yeah, it's really, really intriguing.
I think dramatic musicals stick with you longer than the comedies do. You know, I remember it more because as a young theater person, it's so dramatic and so cool and so interesting. And those memories stay a lot longer than I can't remember when I saw Hello, Dolly. You know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Things that are frothy and fun versus something that is really powerful and very, very poignant. And, of course, that is certainly the case with Cabaret. I suspect most of our listeners have at least a general sense of what this show is about, but I think it's important for us to set it out very, very clearly. Tell us the time and place in which Cabaret is set and kind of the heart and soul of its story.
Sure. The story is set in 1930s Berlin. It's a time of decadence, and but it also is the rise of Nazism and the Jewish persecution. And so in this world, this nightclub, we have Cliff, who is an American writer who has come to Berlin to write the greatest novel ever written, you know. And he meets Sally Bowles, who is a British singer who is in the nightclub, and they fall in love and have a relationship and end up in this boarding house that's run by a strong German lady who actually falls in love with a Jewish man. And they're so adorable and sweet and cute. And so we have two kind of competing love stories here with different backgrounds and different relationships, and in this world of this nightclub, which we have this rise of Nazism and this type of government that they're living in. And so out of this world, you know, different, I don't want to give away all the endings and things that happen, but, you know, these relationships are quite different. And, you know, people have to make choices in their life. And Frau Snyder talks about, you know, if the Nazis come to power, I will survive. If the communists come to power, I will survive. And they talk about how do we navigate this? We have had inflation and we've had two wars and I survive. And, you know, what would you do? What would you do if you were me? And I think that's a really strong theme of this show. If you were put in that situation, what would you do? And in Cliff's world, Cliff wants out. We're leaving. We're not going to be in this place. We can't be here. And Sally's at a different point in her life. She's got a career. She doesn't care about politics. She, you know, loves the limelight. And, Cliff has another line in the play with where he says something similar to, you know, if you're not against this, you're for this. Mm. And so, you know, in this crazy, decadent, seedy nightclub, we have some pretty strong themes about, you know, right and wrong and what would you do and how do you survive when you are facing such odds. So, and marvelous music thrown in, and I don't use the word marvelous too often, but the score is so amazing. It's great storytelling. You know, we did Mamma Mia, which is a fun show, but they just throw music in there and they try to make a story out of it. Every one of these songs tells a specific story. It's there for a reason, and it helps the story, and it's moving. So I'm very excited to work on it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. Let's talk for a moment about this intriguing figure of the MC, who is the MC of this nightclub, the Kit Kat Club. Tell our listeners what you think this MC represents, and in a sense, the role beyond just the standard role that's kind of on the page that the MC plays in Cabaret.
Yeah, it's a very complex character. And I think probably people could write doctorate theses on, you know, what they actually meant by it. But this character is, you know, his opening line is, leave your troubles outside. You know, life is beautiful. People are beautiful. The orchestra is beautiful. Come to the cabaret. Forget your problems. And in that world of trying to, everything is okay. Everything is fun. And we find out it's not fun, and we disguise things. And so, you know, the MC, you know, disguises a lot. We're not really sure who this person is. It's not fleshed out in the story, really, about the background. In our version, he owns the club and has affairs with everybody, boys, girls, doesn't really matter, and is that that evil theater owner who exploits their employees. But, you know, this he's show business. It's all about fluff and all about masking the truth. Now, again, I don't want to give away the end. In our version, in the 1998 version, there's a really strong twist at the end where art and reality come together in a very shocking way that is different than the other versions. The other versions kind of leave you hanging, as it were. In this version, it's got a very clear outcome of what happens to these people and what happens if we don't stand up, if we just try to mask all of this and we just try to dismiss it and think it's fluff. So I don't know if I've answered your question, because the MC is such a complicated role, especially in our version.
And here is a little bit of the very first thing that he sings, Willkommen, welcoming everyone to the cabaret. And again, this is Alan Cummings from the 1998 version.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleib, rest, stay. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Im Cabaret, au Cabaret, au Cabaret. Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, guten Abend, bonsoir, good evening. Wie geht's? Comment ça va? Do you feel good?
Yeah, I bet you do.
Ich bin euer Conferencia, je suis votre compère. I am your host. Und sage willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Im Cabaret, au Cabaret, au Cabaret.
We have Doug Instanis with us in the studio talking about the Racine Theatre Guild's production of the musical Cabaret by John Kander and Fred Ebb. It opens this Friday night and runs for the next 3 weekends. You were just saying, as we were listening to Alan Cummings from the 1998 version, that that's essentially the version that the Racine Theatre Guild is electing to do. And I'd be curious to know, you know, what drew you to that particular version. But you were also saying off the mic, but I think it's a good thing to talk about, that this 1998 version, when you watch it, it's a really raunchy show. Mm-hmm. I mean, R-rated for sure, probably a couple places that are more like rated X. And not surprisingly, you have made the choice to pull away from that. And it's not just because, you know, you don't want to, you know, angry, upset patrons on your hands, but there's a really artistic reason why you are choosing to pull away from some of those details that are sometimes seen in productions of cabaret.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of versions of this, and from high school to, you know, what you just mentioned on Broadway. And there's varying degrees of sexuality and, you know, the rawness of the show. In my mind, it has to have some, obviously. It's a seedy nightclub. So, you know, this play is not something young children should come see, because it has adult themes and adult situations. So please be aware of that. However, if you go too over the top with it, you're missing the love story. You're missing the point of the play. I don't want people to just go away and say, oh, they were making out in their underwear. That's what you remember. If you don't remember the wonderful songs and the relationships between the two people, then we didn't do our job. And so in this CD world, what you have to create, and to do that, you know, we have some risque costumes and some risque movement, but it doesn't overshadow the powerful story and the heartbreak that goes into these characters as they have to choose in their life what direction to go, you know, what, where's life going to take them. So this version has a very different ending, which we liked, and has a couple of really great songs. They've added a couple songs that are just so marvelous. And, you know, with everything, when the show was written in the 60s, it's a little dated. So I think over the years they've said, well, let's change this out. This doesn't ring the same way to today's audiences as it did in 1966. So the language and, you know, some of the situations are more updated, so it seems fresher and not so locked into time, because this really is a timeless story. The reason that this has been successful over 60 years is because we're still trying to deal with those type of issues, you know, making the choice between good and bad. What would you do if you were me, type of situations, and the rise of you know, racism and discrimination and government interference and all of that. You know, unfortunately, you know, we're still dealing with some of those same issues. So we're just trying to do it in a modern way.
Right. One of the most amazing songs in this show, of course, was not even part of the original show on Broadway back in 1966. And that's the incredible song that Sally Bowles sings, Maybe This Time, which was from another musical by Kander and Ebb, a failed musical. So it really saw the light of day, I understand, in the iconic 1972 film version with Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli singing this. Can you just say a quick word about this particular song and what it says about the character of Sally Bowles before we hear just a little of it?
Well, Sally's had lots of passionate love affairs in her life, and she talks about that and she details them, and they've always ended poorly. And people go their separate ways and people change. And she starts thinking to herself, maybe this time it's going to work. Maybe this time I can have a good life and somebody who cares about me. And so, you know, she sings about that. And, of course, in our version, it goes from an internal monologue to a stage production, which is a very interesting take that they do with the in and out of reality into performance mode. But Sally is struggling with her own self because she always thought she knew what was best for her and this is the direction I'm going to go, and that people will treat me poorly. But maybe this time it'll be different. Mm. And it's just a beautiful song.
Yeah, and really heartbreaking in a lot of ways. And, of course, it's become a standard that has taken on a life of its own even outside of performances of the actual musical. So this is actually going to be a little bit of a performance that I really love by the great Christian Chenoweth, again, of the song Maybe This Time from Cabaret.
Maybe this time I'll be lucky. Maybe this time he'll stay. Maybe this time, for the first time, love won't hurry away. He will hold me fast. I'll be home at last. Not a loser anymore, like the last time and the time before. Everybody loves a winner, so nobody loved me. Lady peaceful, lady happy, that's what I long to be. Are
One of the really most amazing songs ever written, maybe this time, now part of the show Cabaret, actually written for an entirely different show called Golden Gate, which, as far as I know, has to this day never seen the light of day. But the song, of course, is one of the most unforgettable moments from Kander and Ebb's musical Cabaret. It opens this Friday night at the Racine Theater Guild. We have the stage director, Doug Instanis, joining us today to talk about the production. Maybe say a quick word about the production as you have kind of conceived it and the way that the action unfolds on the stage of the Guild.
Well, I like the latest Broadway version of it. They redid the theater. They made it into a nightclub. And the audience is part of the action where they sit and they, you know, can have a drink and experience it as they would have in 1930s Berlin. Now, of course, we can't remodel our theater, but we've taken that to heart, and we've got cabaret tables. So it's a lot of the cast never leaves the stage. They just go and they watch the performance as spectators. And when their role comes up, they go do their job, or they help move scenery, and the MC orchestrates it. So it's really, you know, kind of a play within a play, where everybody's experiencing this production. And that allows a lot of freedom to us. So we don't have to recreate a full apartment, and we don't have to recreate a fruit shop, and we don't have to fly in all these massive sets. It's very theatrical, and moves quickly from one location to another with the MC, orchestrating it. So, there's lots of lights, lots of sound, lots of, you know, fog and strobe lights and all the cool theatrical tricks.
Mm. I know that one of the things you have to be so pleased about is not only do you have really strong people in the principal roles, but you also have a really great group of Kit Kat dancers. I mean, there's no point in doing cabaret if you don't have some ladies who can really deliver all that is demanded of the Kit Kat girls.
Yeah, our choreographer, Mary Lee Storino, has done a marvelous job. Perfectly Marvelous, that's another song, with these ladies. And they are just doing an amazing job. It's hard. And they are working extremely hard. And they're doing an excellent job. It's fun. It's that Fosse type of dancing where you're very theatrical and unique and interesting. And while some things are very together and like the kick line, there are lots of things where everybody's individual and everybody is different, but they're the same. It's hard to explain when everybody is out there doing something different. You don't know who to watch because they're all so interesting and cool and
right.
Very talented ladies. And we're very grateful to have them. And then the guys come in, and then they add a whole different dynamic to it.
Yeah, they really do.
Very exciting. And it's not very big. So that's, you know, we have a rather small ensemble. So there, it's not like 30 people on stage. You know, the whole cast is 17, and there's only 10 of those are ensemble. Hmm. And so they got a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. They make a big difference. I do want to make sure we take a minute or two to, although it warrants more than that, that is the relationship, sort of the subplot of the musical between Fräulein Schneider, who is a German boarding house owner, and the Jewish fruit vendor, Herr Schultz, and the two of them, the way in which they fall in love. And this, of course, just from the description, one can tell this is a doomed relationship, a doomed romance. Can you just say a little bit about just how important this is to the overall musical?
To be honest, I don't know who I feel more sorry for, Schultz or Schneider, because Frau Schneider's run this boarding house and has been a survivor her whole life, and she's tough. And there's a line in there, how many meals have you had alone? 100, and it's just thousands of meals I've had alone. Well, you know, and they find each other, and they're so adorable, and they care about each other for all the right reasons. He's got a line, I have so much tenderness for you, it's hard to explain. And in this world of hatred, it doesn't even occur to her that religion would be a problem. And then when she finds out it is a problem, she has to make a choice. Does she give up on happiness just to survive? It's a tough decision, you know. And there's a wonderful song. What would you do? What would you do if you were me? Tell me. I will listen. Mm. It's easy for you to judge. It's easy for you to say what you would do. But you're not living here. You're not trying to make a living. You know, people have come and go in our lives, and I'm still here. I'm still standing. But it's a lonely life.
Yeah.
And it's too bad that – and that's one of the lessons that we learn. It's too bad. You have to make that choice.
Right. It's a choice no one should be forced to make.
Make, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, for all of the darkness and drama and poignancy, this is also, of course, a show that's full of life and vibrancy, lots of great humor. Mm. And we'll finish out, actually, with the song – Perfectly Marvelous, which is one of my favorites. We'll be hearing it as it was performed by the original cast of the show. So Cabaret is opening this Friday night and runs for the next 3 weekends. And for people who are curious and hoping to come see it, what do they do?
Well, you can call the box office at 262-633-4218. The box office is open Monday through Friday, noon to 6. You can order tickets online. We have a webpage, or just stop by our lobby and buy some tickets. I wouldn't wait to the day of the performance, though, because tickets are going, and you want to get them as early as possible. So call the box office or go online or stop by relatively soon.
Very good. Doug Instanis, thank you for being our guest today on The Morning Show to talk about Cabaret.
Thank you.
I met this perfectly marvelous girl in this perfectly wonderful place as I lifted a glass to the start of a marvelous year. Before you knew it, she called on the phone, inviting. Next moment, I was no longer alone, but sat reciting some perfectly beautiful verse in my charming American style. How I dazzled her senses was truly no less than a crime. Now I've this perfectly marvelous girl in my perfectly beautiful room, and we're living together and having a marvelous time.
Oh, Sally, I'm afraid it wouldn't work. You're much too distracting.
Distracting? No, inspiring. She tells me perfectly marvelous tales of her thrillingly scandalous life, which I'll probably use as a chapter or two in my book. And since my stay in Berlin was to force creation, what luck to fall on a fabulous source of stimulation. And perfectly marvelous too is her perfect agreement to be just as still as a mouse while I'm giving my novel a whirl. Yes, I've a highly agreeable life in my perfectly beautiful room with my nearly invisible, perfectly marvelous girl.
I met this truly remarkable girl in this really incredible town, and she skillfully managed to talk her way into my room.
Okay.
I have a terrible feeling I've said a dumb thing. Besides, I've only got one narrow bed.
We'll think of something.
Now this wild, unpredictable girl,
and this perfectly beautiful man.